The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from West Babylon, New York, this is Sports Talk 1240.
And what's up, everybody? It is Sports Talk 1240 here on this Sunday night, coming to you from the studios at WGBB 1240 AM in Babylon, New York. I am Andy Sugo. We have a fun show for you today, as we are 1 week away from the Super Bowl of New York Nightmares. We'll be bringing on Andy Madison from Kick Off Your Sunday. He'll be coming on to talk about the Super Bowl and what his thoughts are. And we've been talking during the week, and he's got this crazy hot take for me that, as much as I want to believe him, I don't know if it's going to happen, but I will get into that with him when he gets on the air. But like I said, we are 1 week away from the biggest TV event of the year, as all eyes, all sporting eyes, anyway, converge on Minneapolis, Minnesota, where Darth Vader, Darth Sidious, Tom Brady and Bill Belichick and the New England Patriots take on what could have been Carson Wentz, but is now Nick Foles. I know everybody's saying, who's that at this point? And the Philadelphia Eagles. For the Patriots, it's their 10th Super Bowl appearance in their history, and the 8th in the last 18 years. So think about that for a minute. They've been in nearly 50% of the Super Bowls that have been played in Tom Brady's career. Nearly 50%. The actual number is 44.4. I do remember math. This is a big thing for me. But 45% of the Super Bowls has had the same team over and over and over and over again. And they've now been in 3 of 4, as they were in Super Bowl 49 and they won. They were in Super Bowl 51 and they won. Everybody knows the story, down 28-3 late in the third quarter, and Tom Brady does Tom Brady things. Everybody's favorite. We've all seen that movie before. They're down two scores to the Jacksonville Jaguars in the AFC Championship game last week. And we were all just waiting for it. When are the Patriots going to turn it on and the Jaguars are going to have no response? And that came midway through the third quarter. And we all knew it was coming and kind of expected it. I was in a bar in Stamford, Connecticut. And Connecticut is, depending on where you are in Connecticut, it's either New York country or New England country. So you get an interesting mix of people. You had all the people who were the Jets and Giants fans that are watching this game and saying, "Oh God, here we go again. Tom Brady's going to lead this team to victory." And then you had all the Patriot fans on the other side of the bar. It was completely separated. Like there was no like intermingling. All the Patriots fans are just sitting on one side of the bar, and they're all saying, "Yeah, go Patriots! We're gonna win this game. We got this." Going on and on and on. And eventually you knew it was coming, and Blake Bortles was not able to hang on for that win. But I will say this for the Jacksonville Jaguars: they had a great season, a little bit unexpected, but good on them, and I hope they can make it back again next season and hopefully take out the New England Patriots if they get so lucky to do so. I don't think anybody would be too opposed to that except for Patriot fans. Then go to the NFC. You got the Philadelphia Eagles. Carson Wentz goes down with a torn ACL, and I'm pretty sure everybody thought, okay, it's over. This team doesn't have it. They lose their star quarterback. They deal with other injuries. There's no way that Nick Foles is going to be able to do what the potential MVP could do. And what does Nick Foles do? He turns it back to 2012 when he took over for Michael Vick and threw 26 touchdowns. And he has yet to throw an interception in the playoffs. He goes in. He's an underdog to Atlanta. And the defense holds up on the goal line. They went 15-10. They play Minnesota, the Minnesota Miracle team that, who knows if they were even supposed to be there to that game against New Orleans. and they go out there and they absolutely smoke the Minnesota Vikings, who are looking to play a home game in the Super Bowl. But Nick Foles had something else to say about that, and he's now going to Minnesota to take on the big, bad New England Patriots and the Death Star of talent they have. So that's gonna be an interesting game. But who is New York rooting for? You could take this in multiple ways. You know Jet fans will never root for the New England Patriots under any circumstances, and they would rather miss the playoffs if the Patriots needed to win a game for them to make it to the playoffs than see the Patriots win anything, even if it's to their benefit. And New York Giants fans hate the Philadelphia Eagles so much that they could never root for the Philadelphia Eagles. But then there's other factors that go into it. Say you're a Mets fan and you are a Giants fan. You hate the Philadelphia Eagles, and I'm sorry. Let me backtrack a little bit. If you're a Yankees fan and Giants fan, you hate the Philadelphia Eagles. But as a Yankee fan, you don't really like the city of Boston much because of the Red Sox. So are you really going to root for the Patriots? And if you're a Jets fan, and Mets fan, you hate the Philadelphia Phillies. So you're not going to be inclined to root for a Philadelphia team either. So there's the conundrum where both teams just make New York fans upset no matter what happens. And whoever you wind up picking to win here in New York, you're basically just holding your nose and swallowing because you just don't want to deal with it. And there's always the option of, you know, something happens to the stadium before the game and they have to postpone the game, but that doesn't happen, especially with brand new stadiums. And that's just wishful thinking for anybody out there who wants to just hope that something hits the stadium and they have to cancel the game. Sorry, it's not going to happen. As much as I think Minnesota fans would be kind of upset that their brand new stadium got destroyed, I will say this: I give Viking fans a lot of credit that they're going to be Uber. That a lot of them are going to be Uber drivers, and I'm pretty sure no Eagles fan. Every Eagle fan that gets into an Uber during this week is probably going to have the address that they're going in the GPS themselves, just to make sure that Viking fans aren't messing with them after some of the reports that came out of what happened during the NFC Championship game in Philadelphia, which included fans being assaulted. You had fans that had hats taken from them and urinated on in the bathroom, which, you know, that's Bush League. You know, if you're there at the game and you paid money to see the game, you don't want to be bothered. I understand that you're wearing your team's gear at an opposing stadium, and I've done it before multiple times, and I've taken my ribs for it, and nearly gotten myself in trouble for it, but never got to the point where it got physical, and that just goes to show that the Philadelphia fans' reputation isn't exactly unfounded. You had two guys punch police horses. What makes you think that's a good idea? That you're going to go out there and assault a police animal? Not even, and by extension, you're assaulting the cop by hitting his animal that he's riding. You can't do that. These are the people who threw batteries and snowballs at Santa Claus, and you're going to punch a police horse. Sometimes I don't know what to think when you hear stories about that, and all you can do at a certain point is just shake your head and say that everybody can't be like this. And I know everybody's not like that. It's just the few bad seeds that you hear about. But it just happens more and more when it comes to the Philadelphia Eagles and the Philadelphia Flyers. And you hope that doesn't happen at the Super Bowl, because that would just be a complete black eye on the NFL when they have all eyes on them for their big stage. And with that, I'm going to bring in the host of Kick Off Your Sunday, a good friend of mine, Andy Madison. Andy, thank you for joining me tonight.
You're welcome, Sukoff. I'm glad I could do it. I'm just sitting here in LaGuardia, you know, waiting to get on my flight to Minnesota for Super Bowl week here. Hang on. What's that? You bumped me from first class? What?
Oh, I'm sorry. Did the credit card payment not go through?
You know, honestly, I just wanted to say my dreams out loud and just hear kind of what that would sound like, you know.
Your dreams include getting bumped from first class. That's kind of sad. I'm really sorry to hear that.
I know, right? Well, listen, I'm a coach person, you know. I'm like, I want to be with the people, with Middle America, you know.
I like that. So I know I'm making take off your Sunday work the overnight, and for that I appreciate you coming here.
Of course, absolutely.
So let's talk about this New York nightmare that's going to be happening in 7 days from now. The evil Empire and the Philadelphia Eagles will be facing off in a Super Bowl rematch from 2004. And what are your thoughts on what we're going to see on Sunday?
I think the Eagles, and you're right about this is a New York nightmare. I have gone back and forth on this a lot this week, trying to figure out, and you brought up a really good point when we were talking earlier. You can root against one team. You're not necessarily rooting for the other team, but you can do that. And this is what I think, honestly, and this is impartial, total observation in looking at everything. The Philadelphia Eagles can absolutely beat the New England Patriots. The Patriots are beatable. Every one of their Super Bowls that they have won, the games have all been close. They have not been a blowout by a long shot. And the Patriots have actually never scored in the first quarter. And I think, and I've had conversations with, you know, Eagles fans and Patriots fans this week, I think that the Eagles absolutely can come up with a blueprint to beat the Patriots. And what is it that you've got to do? How can you beat the Patriots? And the Jags kind of tried to do it, and they were doing it for three quarters of football in the AFC Championship game before they got to the fourth, and they didn't trust Blake Bortles, and they got way too conservative with the play calling. You pressure Brady. You get to Brady. You hit him. And the Eagles' defense, they have a championship-caliber defense that I think can do it. And I think if they get to Brady and they get pressure on him, then and they just ask Nick Foles to kind of – and they can run the ball. And I don't think the Patriots' run defense is that good. They can run the ball. That Jay Ajayi addition in the middle of the season I think can really help the Eagles. So that is what I'm – now, this is – it's tough because, you know, going out on a limb and saying, well, that the Eagles can beat the Patriots, does that mean I have to pick the Eagles? Because, like, you want to go – you don't want to just make these kind of declarative, you know, statements. – I mean, it seems like an obvious statement, like, well, yeah, of course the Eagles can beat the Patriots, you know, and the Patriots can beat the Eagles. Are you really going out on a limb and going to pick them? That's sort of something that I'm sort of wrestling with. Am I bold enough to think, like, I can, you know, like, picking the Eagles to beat the Patriots? But the first thing that jumps out to me is I think the Eagles can absolutely beat the Patriots.
So you think that the running game of Philadelphia can be an X factor next weekend in Minnesota?
Absolutely. I think that if they can come up on the offensive side of the ball, as long as Nick Foles, and I know we've said this, you and I have talked about this a lot, if Nick Foles, if the moment is not too big for him, if he doesn't get out there and just go, oh my God, I'm in the Super Bowl, as long as he can kind of maintain his composure and they stick with the game plan that they had in the NFC Championship game, because, you know, Minnesota scores and strikes first on the road and all of a sudden it's 7-0. The Eagles didn't panic. The Eagles stuck to their game plan, and Nick Foles has played decent, I think, in this postseason. So I think you've got Alshon Jeffrey. If Nick Foles, they don't ask Nick Foles to do too much. They don't have to because they've got a decent running game that I think can complement the offense. It looks like to me, from a football perspective, what is it that, you know, every quarterback, if not like a game manager, but if there's a quarterback out there who doesn't, you don't put the game in his hands. If he's got a decent running game, you know, that's kind of a good ham and egg combo, in my opinion, on offense.
Okay. What about defensively? The Eagles last week, they were all over the Minnesota Vikings, and they forced Case Keenum into more mistakes than he had made probably in the last 6 weeks of the season and in the playoffs against New Orleans. besides getting pressure on Brady, which is obvious, we've seen that blueprint happen multiple times in the playoffs. As we watched Rex Ryan do it against them with Baltimore and with the New York Jets, we watched Tom Coughlin do it in the Super Bowl twice with the New York Giants. What do you have to see from the secondary, and especially with the questionable status of Rob Gronkowski for Sunday's game? What does the secondary have to really focus on to get past that?
I think they've got to focus on, certainly have got to focus on Rob Gronkowski, and they've got to focus on Amendola. Amendola came up big for the Patriots in the AFC Championship game, but it really, a lot of it is predicated on Gronk's health. I have no idea how the concussion protocol is going to go. We don't know anything. I mean, Gronk was limited in practice, and he's probably going to be limited right up until the game. But one thing, when you were talking about the previous Super Bowl, Super Bowl 46, it was Gronk's health that was an issue as well, because I think he had the ankle, and then they gave him the cortisone shot at halftime. But the problem is that in Super Bowl, the halftime is longer than usual. And so I think that impacted him, because remember, Brady tried to throw the jump ball to him in the fourth quarter that ended up getting intercepted by Chase Blackburn. So I think a lot of it has to do with Gronk's health and what the secondary is going to do. I mean, do you double Gronk? Brady is really good at spreading the ball around, certainly. So I think the secondary has got to key in on Gronk and on Amendola. Now, one interesting, I know we talked about the defensive front. One guy that to keep an eye on, who has done wonders for the Eagles and has been a real big part of their defense this season, is Chris Long. And Chris Long was on the Patriots the year before. I mean, how great is that? Chris Long plays most of his career in the NFL, goes to the Patriots last year on a bargain, gets the Super Bowl ring, then tests free agency, signs with the Eagles, and now he's right back in the Super Bowl playing against the Patriots.
Don't you love how that works when you jump from a Super Bowl winner and then go right to another team that makes a run to the number one seed in the conference and gets back to the Super Bowl, and now you got the chance to win Super Bowls with different teams in back-to-back years?
He's like Deion Sanders in the 90s. You know, Sanders was on, like, the Cowboys, and then he was on the 49ers. And I want to say he jumped to one of those teams and was in the Super Bowl, like, the next season, if I'm not mistaken. I'd have to look that up.
Yeah, because he went to the Super Bowl in 94 with the 49ers, where they beat the Chargers pretty handily. And he signed a one-year deal with them, then goes down to Dallas and wins the Super Bowl against Pittsburgh. And then Dallas hasn't been back since.
What do you think, speaking of Dallas and their dynasty, what do you think about the possibility of the Patriots dynasty, I don't want to say crumbling, but like, if, I mean, do you see a scenario where this is, in fact, because that the ESPN article was talking about Seth Wickersham wrote that article, that some people think this might be the last season for this group.
My answer to that is it doesn't end until Brady wants it to end. They're gonna lose Matt Patricia and Josh McDaniels, but until Brady goes away and Belichick goes away, they're always going to be in it. I don't think ultimately that they're gonna break it up this year. Like when you watch the Chicago Bulls after the 98 championship and then they had the lockout, Jordan retired, Pippen was traded, so you lose your two biggest stars, and you had to rely on guys like an aging Ron Harper, Tony Kukoc, who you can't expect to be a number one,
yeah,
and Luke Longley, who is just kind of there. Those aren't the guys who can lead a team back to the championship. Tom Brady can do that.
He absolutely can. And we have no indication of when Bill Belichick is going to retire. The only indication we've got is he was quoted, I think, I don't know if it was in that the NFL Films piece on him, but at some point he said he didn't want to be like Marv Levy and coach until he's 70. So, Marv Levy, the former Bills coach.
Which would then be only another couple years, as he's now 66.
Yeah, that's true. He's getting up there.
But if the team is still competing and he's still doing well, that could always change. Marv Levy, towards the end, the Bills weren't all that good. So you can understand him retiring at a certain point, because at that point, Kelly had retired. So he had lost his franchise quarterback. And they were starting on their way down, where they were about to go on an 18-year stretch where they didn't make the playoffs. The Patriots, at this point, don't have that, don't have any indications of that.
No, they really don't, and that's the fascinating thing kind of about the Patriots is how mysterious and buttoned up they are. I mean, no one knows the details of Belichick's contract. No, I mean, no one really knows what his relationship is like with Robert Kraft. I mean, some you might think that they've got a plan, they've got an exit strategy, but you really don't know. And it was Tom Brady's dad, I think, was quoted at some point saying that he thought it was going to end badly with the Patriots. So really, nobody has any idea of kind of, you know, where you go. I know this though. I am pumped to see the two Bills 30 for 30, which I think comes out this week, which will be another interesting look inside the mind of Belichick because he rarely ever does interviews.
Yeah, when I spoke to Marcus Coleman a couple weeks ago, he echoed similar sentiments that like how like getting into Belichick's mind is one of the more incredible things, and seeing how he adjusts in game is truly incredible.
We'll talk real quickly about the Patriots too, and I think one way that they're kind of viewing this matchup is it's the most annoying fan base versus the second most annoying fan base, which I think is kind of a good way to describe Patriots fans and Eagles fans. I'll give just one quick example. I know, as you do, and I know I don't have to tell you how obnoxious Patriots fans are, the term mansplaining, you know, you've heard of this term,
yes,
right?
Yes.
I always thought that this was like a silly term and it was just something that like people created or whatever, and I kind of never really understood the point of it. And then I spoke to a Patriots fan and had the lovely experience of having a Patriots fan say to me, you know, Bill Belichick was the Giants defensive coordinator. Really? Like I was born yesterday? Is that who I was watching in Super Bowl 25? Oh, it was him. And so now I totally get it. Now I kind of get that whole thing. And now I'm kind of like, oh, yeah, that is kind of obnoxious. So that's just something that we're all dealing with. And another thing from the Eagles' perspective, too, everybody loves a good underdog, and I feel like Patriots fans aren't giving, or people who are looking at this matchup, I don't want to say no one's giving the Eagles a chance, because we have not heard any predictions or any talk, because Super Bowl week doesn't really get started until tomorrow, but I feel like there are a lot of Patriots fans that are probably looking at this and just thinking it's a foregone conclusion that they're going to have a parade next week. And I think the Eagles have a really good shot here. The Patriots are beatable, you know. Now, listen, if you're going to look at the coaching matchup, Belichick versus Peterson, Belichick's going to get the edge, certainly. But, you know, the Jaguars got to Brady, and they got pressure on Brady. And if you have an opportunistic defense like the Eagles, I really think that if they can use that whole first quarter, if they can set the tone early, I really think the Eagles have a good shot in this game.
All right, speaking of creating things, one of my favorite parts of Super Bowl week is seeing all the prop bets that show up. And
yes.
One of the ones I saw that's at, I think it was like 120 to 1, is Steven Gutkowski being the Super Bowl MVP. Interestingly enough, he's got better odds than any defensive player on either team.
Ooh, that's an interesting prop bet. And he's been pretty good in the playoffs, too.
Now I have to ask you, what would be your favorite prop bet? And if you had to create a prop bet, what would it be?
Ooh, let's see. Now this is everything, like Super Bowl coverage, commercials, all that stuff.
And anything you want.
Okay. The one prop bet that I do like is will there be a safety? Will a safety be recorded in this game, either for the Patriots or for the Eagles? And then the other prop bet that I do like is the duration of the national anthem. I don't know what time they set it at, but I think you can bet like will the national anthem last longer than 3 minutes or less than 3 minutes or something like that, I believe.
Yes.
That's one of my favorites. Let's see. Another prop bet would probably be something with the commercials. Like will Doritos have four or more commercials in the Super Bowl?
That's always a fun one too. It's like,
yeah.
One of the ones I saw was will Rob Gronkowski's longest catch be longer than the number of points that Kyrie Irving scores in the game against Portland that day?
Ooh, that's a good one.
Man, I didn't see what the running odds were, but is it like when you come up with something that insane, like that's when you know somebody's got way too much time on their hands.
Yeah, no, that's true. Or they're just trying to cash in from all the money that can be made in the Super Bowl.
Which goes to show you how, you know, the ratings might be down a little bit, but this is still a billion-dollar industry, and the sports betting is still prime for football, no matter what happens.
It's very interesting you talk about the ratings, too, because that plays into the Thursday night football package, which nobody likes, but they're going to keep doing it. Why? Because money talks, especially with all the networks. I mean, if they really wanted to have a concerted effort to reduce the number of Thursday night football games, the networks could just say, listen, we're not doing this. But the ratings are too good, and they know if they walk away, they know it'll just get swallowed up by somebody else.
And we're going to switch gears. First I do want to get your prediction, and then we're going to switch gears to something else that nobody watched because it was very early in the morning.
I know.
Your prediction for the Super Bowl.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, see, now I've made the case for the Eagles, and we're a week out, so there's a lot that can happen.
Early prediction, then. Early prediction.
Okay, all right, early prediction. Okay, I still got to go with the Patriots. I'm going, okay, Patriots 20, Eagles 10. I know, see, this is the thing where I really, and I was talking about this earlier today, I want to make a strong case for the Eagles, but I just can't, like, when push comes to shove, I can't just, like, you know, lay my money down and be like, all right, the Eagles can do this, you know, I'm betting the Eagles. You can't go against Belichick and Brady.
And that goes to show the greatness of the New England Patriots and why they've made New York miserable for 20 years.
Exactly. Oh, jeez.
But now I'm going to switch gears. We've got a few couple minutes left with you. We were talking about it last night. You asked me if you should wake up at 4 a.m. to watch it. And it was the Australian Open men's final, Roger Federer's Marin Cilic. Or Roger Federer won his 20th Grand Slam championship, his 6th Australian Open, which is tied for most ever with Roy Emerson and Novak Djokovic. You watched the replay later on. What did you see from the 36-year-old Federer?
What I saw was he took over in the fifth set. He started and he finished. I mean, Cilic played tight in the first set, so it was like 6-2, like in a blink of an eye. Then Cilic finally got it together, won the second set, and then it looked like Federer was going to cruise. Federer won the third, looked like he was going to cruise in the fourth, but then Cilic played him, you know, serve for serve, and then they went to a fifth, and then finally Federer just took it to another level, and Cilic couldn't keep up. And it was interesting how you kind of looked at it as, when you play Federer, you got to be 100%. I mean, Cilic, you know, he gave him the first set, and you can't do that against Roger Federer, you know. And I feel like Cilic is a good player, certainly, but Federer something happened to him in the fourth set where he was carrying the momentum from the third set over to the fourth, but then Cilic caught up with him, and next thing you know, we're headed to a fifth. But the thing was that I could have woken up early, but then if it was a marathon five-set match, I probably wouldn't have been able to stay up for all of it, but I could have woken up maybe later, like 5 or 6 a.m. East Coast time, to catch the fifth set. But it's just something I continue to be impressed by Roger Federer's play.
And what's amazing is that even with this win, he will still not be the world number one. He's going to be ranked number two now, as Rafael Nadal making it to the quarterfinals down under gets to keep his number one ranking.
Which is weird. The ranking system kind of puzzles me in that regard. And then also one thing to look at is it'll be interesting to see what happens with Nadal's health, because he retired in that match due to an injury.
Yep. Now, it's undisputed at this point that Roger Federer is the greatest of all time. Is there anybody out there right now, and this is a young man's game, and meanwhile you have guys in their mid-30s who are the world's number one and two. Is there anybody out there who can catch them?
No, see, no name is coming to mind for me. I keep wanting to make the argument or make the case for someone like Stan Wawrinka or Del Potro, but they're just they're not consistent enough. Where they, I feel like there are a lot of players out there that are just going to be like James Blake. They're like they're good, but they're not great. They never kind of got up to that level of Nadal and Federer. And I mean, while we're on the topic of men's tennis, where are the American men?
They're terrible.
What happened? It's awful. I mean, yikes.
And when you look at that, there hasn't been a men's champion in 15 years. That's a problem, especially when you had Pete Sampras, Andre Agassi, Michael Chang, and then Roddick. And so you had a good 20-year stretch, and even before that, when you had Connors, McEnroe, Courier, where they were at the top of men's tennis, and now it's just they're lost in the shuffle.
Did you ever think you were going to see a day, too, when it was that bad for men's tennis? I mean, 15 years? That's a crazy stat.
I don't think anybody saw that coming. I think there were a lot of expectations placed on James Blake that he didn't live up to. Then you had John Isner, who he can have that marathon match and then lose the next day unceremoniously. You have Jack Sock now, who he's up and down. And then Sam Querrey also, he goes to the semifinals last year at Wimbledon. And then lays an egg at the Australian Open this year. So we'll see what happens through the clay season before the French Open, and we'll see maybe American tennis can start to rebound from there.
At least get on the level of what American women's tennis is, you know, because there are some exciting players that are coming from America that have played well in Grand Slams recently.
Yes, there are women like Madison Keys, Coco Vandeweghe, Sloane Stephens. So. After the Williams sisters retire, which who knows when that will be, because they're still at the top of their game, at least there's a crop of American women who are just gonna slot right in.
I'm hitching my wagon to Madison Keys. I'm hopping on the Madison Keys bandwagon.
And we spoke about this. I'm on the Coco Vandeweghe bandwagon. I'm a big fan of hers. I think she's an incredible player, and I think she's got a major or two in her.
I think you're right too. I think she's a good player as well.
All right, we're going to let you go because we're about to go on break. So, again, Andy, I just want to thank you for taking the time. And you know I'll be doing Kick Off Your Sunday with you again soon.
Of course, definitely. Thanks for the time. And you're doing a great show. Keep it up, man. I heard they might even, replay this show.
Those are the rumors. I can neither confirm nor deny them.
Okay.
All right, thank you, Andy.
You got it.
All right, that was Andy Madison from Kick Off Your Sunday. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, if you watch today's football game, you need help. We'll be right back. This is Sports Talk 1240.
You are listening to Sports Talk 1240 on Long Island's AM 1240. WGBB.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Want to advertise your business on Sports Talk 1240? Place an ad on sportstalk1240.com and run a radio commercial during the show every Sunday night here on AM 1240 WGBB. Our rates are very affordable. We'll even produce the radio commercial for you. Just head over to sportstalk1240.com and fill out the Contact Us form and let us start promoting your business today.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gustbuster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit Gustbuster.com and get your Gustbuster today.
Stay connected to Sports Talk 1240 by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Sports Talk 1240.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
And we're back for the second half of Hour 1 of Sports Talk 1240. I am Andy Zulov. Again, I want to thank Andy Madison for joining me for the first half. And, of course, I got to give it up to my man Brian Graves as we hang out here on a Sunday night. Always like hanging out with Brian. He's good people. Like I said before the break, there was a football game today. But if you watch it, there's something wrong with you. It was the Pro Bowl. And literally nobody cares about the Pro Bowl. Not the players that are there, not the fans that are there. I don't even know if the TV executives care about the Pro Bowl. They just put it on because they have to, because they're contracted to do it. The game is an utter joke. And for those of you who were watching, aside from the fact that I'll get you a doctor on speed dial, the AFC did win 24-23. They were down big at halftime from what I heard when I was driving earlier, and I guess they came back. But when the NFL has had ratings problems all year due to various social issues and in regards to the kneeling for the national anthem. The Pro Bowl was aired on two networks today. They were aired on ESPN and ABC. So that you're looking at that, and if you're an executive for ABC and you see what their ratings have been, you're a little scared that if you only put it on one network, it's not going to get the ratings that you want. So now you're putting it on both networks to get to that number that you want. But now you're shutting down the other network that you weren't planning on airing that on, where you could put something else that might help you get some more money during those hours. Where you could put a college basketball game there. Or you could put something else that might draw more interest. Instead, you have a football game that nobody in this country could care less about. It's just a meaningless game where defense is optional, and the players have mailed it in. They know that after today, they have 4 months off before they got to do their spring workouts, and some of them are going to get cut, and they're going to have to deal with free agency, and all those players that are playing, the ones who are upcoming free agents, they don't want to get hurt during the Pro Bowl, because if they get hurt, their contract offers go out the window. So you would have to think that their agents are telling them, whatever you do, don't get hurt. It's almost to the point where they might as well just put flags around these guys during the Pro Bowl and just say, all right, we're just going to play flag football, and you're not hitting anybody because we know that you're not really going to be going hard after it anyway. So let's play flag football. It's gotten to that point, and that meaningless of a game where that almost seems like a more viable option than, or just not playing the game at all and just letting it be. At this point, the only All-Star game that actually has any kind of merit is the baseball All-Star game, because you still have to be able to hit the ball. And pitchers aren't throwing meatballs at you during the All-Star game. They're not throwing batting practice. They're still throwing 96 miles an hour at you. So, and I'm glad finally that the baseball commissioner's office finally cleared their heads and got rid of the stipulation that dictated home field advantage for the World Series to the winner of the All-Star game. Because now it's just an exhibition game, which is what it should be, but the players still have to play. And it's in the middle of the season. It gives a nice break in between the first half and the second half of the season, whereas the Pro Bowl is the week before the Super Bowl, the biggest game of the year. So what it really comes down to is the Pro Bowl is in the worst possible spot because everyone's building up the Super Bowl, and the Pro Bowl gets lost in the shuffle. So baseball at least has it right. The NHL is sort of there, but they got some work to do. I like the format that they're doing where they're picking the teams based on the division, and then you have your four divisions play each other, so you do it bracket style. So the Pacific played the Central, the Metro played the Atlantic, and then the Pacific played the Atlantic Division, the Pacific Division won. So they won the All-Star game. Brock Besser named the MVP from the Vancouver Canucks, a rookie for no less. And if you ever get a chance to watch Vancouver Canuck hockey, I do recommend it. They're not the best team in the world, but Brock Besser is one of the top young players in the league. He's got a bright future. and he could be that next guy to take over the mantle of star in Vancouver from the Sedin twins. He's got that kind of ability to do that. But the NHL All-Star game, also a defense optional game, as the scores were quite high, including one of the games, you had 7 goals scored. In the game between the Metro and the Atlantic Division put in 7 goals against the Metro, and that's with a goalie who's one of the best in the NHL, and Henrik Lundqvist. You're giving up 7 goals as part of a team effort. That's not great. And again, I know it's the All-Star game, and it's not a big deal, and it doesn't count for anything, but there's a pride factor on the line. You don't want to be the one who gives up 5 goals. That's just unsightly, even in a game that doesn't mean anything. But the ones who can't get it right no matter what they do, and why anybody watches this game is beyond me, is the NBA All-Star game. I'm going to start from the beginning on this one, because I could go all day on this, but I only got like 20 minutes left, so I'm going to have to keep it short. The NBA All-Star game is the joke among all jokes. I talk about defense being optional in the NHL and the NFL versions of the All-Star game. In the NBA All-Star game, defense is not only optional, it's frowned upon. We're getting dangerously close to a game that's going to have somebody score 200 points. I think last year the final score was like 185 to 179 or something. I'm going to look that up right now, because the score was just so astronomical that it was something that's unseen in a game. The final score was 192 to 182, and the West won. Anthony Davis scored 52 points. That's like almost kids' play at that point when you're putting up that many points. And you just see people just launching up in threes and basically putting the slam dunk contest into a game. Nobody plays defense because nobody wants to get hurt. And again, I understand that, because you have the rest of the season and the playoffs, which, not that the season matters. Everybody knows that the Golden State Warriors are going to the NBA Finals, and it's going to be either the Cleveland Cavaliers or the Boston Celtics coming out of the East. That's been preordained since June, when the Cavaliers and Celtics made the trade that sent Kyrie Irving to Boston, Isaiah Thomas to Cleveland, and the Brooklyn Nets' number one pick to the Cleveland Cavaliers. It's basically preordained that two of those three teams are going to make it to the NBA Finals. So why play games from October to April 15th when you don't really need to? Just pick 16 teams out of a hat and let them play in the playoffs. See, you could have the season over in a month and a half. This year, the NBA tried to shake things up a little bit, and they picked two captains in this year. It's LeBron James and Steph Curry, and they get to pick their teams, which not an awful idea. It's something to think about as a way to shake things up. But then the NBA messed up. That could have been a ratings win for the NBA by showing LeBron James and Steph Curry picking their teams. And we all knew that Kevin Durant was going to be the number one pick by LeBron James. Like, that's without a question. But maybe you want to see the reaction from Steph Curry when he takes his Warrior teammate. And the next pick was then Giannis Antetokounmpo, the Greek Freak. I don't watch the NBA all that much, and I am a huge fan of that kid. He does everything on the court, and he's going to be an MVP at some point soon. But then as things go on, you want to see who gets picked and see the reactions of when people get picked and why, where they got picked. When you see, it's an ego-driven league. It's a star-driven league. And if you're the guy that's picked last, you're still a great player, because you're still one of the top 20 players in the NBA. But you got picked last. Is that why this wasn't shown? Because people are going to feel hurt and betrayed by others because they didn't get picked when they thought they should? That's ridiculous. I got picked last, and it stung for a minute, but I got over it. And I don't make millions of dollars, nor do I need to. I understand that I'm not as good as somebody else, And the All-Stars probably should understand that, too. I'm sorry, DeMar DeRozan. You're not as good as Russell Westbrook. So if I have my choice of Russell Westbrook or you, I'm taking Russell Westbrook. And that's not a knock on you, because you're still a very good player, but Russell Westbrook is just better. And I don't think anybody outside of Toronto would disagree with that. And I don't even think anybody in Toronto would disagree with that. And they're the ones that are wearing your jerseys and buying the tickets to see you play. But even they would take Russell Westbrook over you. So the fact that this wasn't shown on TV is a real mistake for the NBA. But they did rebound from that by... They came out with news this week, and I think this is a great move, that they're going to find a way to get the legalized sports gambling involved with the NBA, and if they want to get they want to get a 1% take of all bets made. That is sheer brilliance by the offices of Adam Silver. That's one of the big parts of why people watch sports now, is for the money that they can make off of everybody else. You put in a bet and you hit, you had the potential of winning huge amounts of money if you hit on certain factors. So with all this money flying around, this is now money in the billions with a B. The NBA gets a 1% take on all bets made from that. That's just an extra couple million dollars that's just sitting in their pockets that they didn't have to do a damn thing for. They could just sit there and let it happen, and they get that money just rolling in. And eventually all the other sports are going to do it too. The NFL, Major League Baseball, the NHL, and you're going to see these leagues start to find ways to implement that. The NFL might ask for a much bigger take. They might ask for maybe 5% of all monies that get placed on bets. And if they do that, they can turn themselves from a $10 billion industry to a potentially $15 or $20 billion industry. And that you tell somebody that 10 years ago, that is unheard of and unthinkable, that any sports league would actively allow gambling to go on and approved on their watch. Because that 10 years ago, that could have led down to a slippery slope where what if somebody gets in touch with the players and finds ways to get players to shave points or throw games? And then that's a complete black eye on that league in whatever aspect that happens. And that might still be an issue when this takes place. But now the NBA has ways to be involved with it and possibly curtail how the access to players for these gamblers and really minimize the potential impact of what gambling could have on the players and their performance. So I'm interested to see the business model of how this is going to go, and I'm actually looking forward to seeing the reports on how this works out for them. I think it's going to be a big win, and for the NBA, that's going to be a huge way for them to really catapult themselves into that top spot of most watched. Because if you can legally place your bets there, and knowing the NBA has got parts of where you can bet even in the middle of games, that's going to make the league much more worthwhile to watch, even if the same two teams are going to the finals every year. Because at least even if you know your team is terrible, you can at least make a couple bucks off them. You know, when they're getting pounded by the Spurs, but they cover the spread, hey, I just made a couple $100. I'm not going to complain. I'm not going to feel so bad that my team is 10-40. Because I just made $250 off of you. Great. Go me. We got about 10 minutes left or so. I just want to throw out a big congratulations to the four newest members of the Baseball Hall of Fame, as they were announced on Wednesday night. And I gotta admit, I feel super old when I say these names, that these are guys that are now going into the Hall of Fame. And those four are Chipper Jones, Vladimir Guerrero, Trevor Hoffman, and Jim Thome. And I say I feel old at 26 because, and I'm sure if I said that to somebody else, they would probably start laughing at me if I said that I feel old at 26. But these are guys that I have watched their entire careers. They were playing when I first started watching baseball, and I grew up watching them and play their entire careers. And the only one that I recall winning a World Series is Chipper Jones, and I was 3 years old when he won, so I really don't have much recollection of that. But these are all guys who I got to watch their entire careers and really get to determine whether they are Hall of Fame worthy or not. Where I'm at the point where all the players who were eligible for induction into the Hall of Fame are the ones who played as I was getting older and going into college and then into professional life. These are the ones who were there playing the game. And I don't have to look back and be like, oh, you know, this guy could make it because of this, or this guy can make it because of this. I can say this guy can make it because I watched him play, I saw him hit those 400-plus home runs and hit 310 and actually know that I saw them play. So, especially Chipper Jones, you know, living here in New York, Chipper Jones, if you say that to the right person, they're going to give you the stink eye, because Chipper Jones probably made them miserable at one point or another in his or her life, as Chipper Jones is the Mets killer of all Mets killers, hitting 49 home runs against the Mets. And you just had, I always respected Chipper Jones, no matter what he did to the New York Mets, because he was just a fun player to watch, and he could really do it all. He's one of the best third basemen I've seen in my lifetime, and he probably goes up there in the top 10 of third basemen all time. And then you look at the other side of the diamond with Jim Thome. Jim Thome, in my opinion, one of the most feared power hitters of the late 90s, early 2000s. And this is the steroid era, when you had Mark McGwire, Sammy Sosa, Barry Bonds, who have all been under the cloud of suspicion, and Jim Thome was never one of them. Meanwhile, Jim Thome just goes along, chugs along, hits 600 home runs, and has a lifetime batting average of 270. Usually when you think of a power hitter, you don't think of a guy who hits 275. You think of a guy who hits 250, 247. You don't think of a guy who's just a few points short of 300. But Jim Thome got there and hit 40 home runs 6 times, drove in plenty of runs, had incredible seasons. And he was the face of those Indian teams in the late 90s that the Yankees basically pushed out of the way on their way to their dynasty. But he was always a fun player to watch. And I will say this, I always wanted the Yankees to get him instead of Jason Giambi. That obviously never happened. But for Jim Thome to get to the Hall of Fame, and on his first ballot, no less, getting a very, very high percentage of the vote, really well earned. And the next few years I really want to go to Cooperstown to see the Hall of Fame induction, because these are all some of my favorite players. It's like I missed 2016 with Ken Griffey Jr., and that just ate me to my core. I don't plan on missing 2019 or 2020 as Mariano Rivera and Derek Jeter get in. This year might be a fun year to go. But if you are planning on going, I would recommend booking now, because everybody and their mother is going to be on, because there are 6 players going to the Hall of Fame, including Alan Trammell and Jack Morris. So there's a lot of people that you're going to be fighting with to try to get a spot and a hotel room, because Cooperstown ain't all that big. Vlad Guerrero, one of my favorite hitters to watch. That guy could literally hit anything. Everybody talks about that pitch that bounced and he hit for a single. I've only saw one other player do that, and that was Ichiro. And that's because Ichiro could also literally hit anything. Vlad Guerrero, again, very feared power hitter, came very close to hitting 40-40 back in 2002, if I remember correctly, with the Montreal Expos. Actually thought he had it, but they called the 40th home run a double, and he got completely robbed, and everybody was up in a furor over that. But there is one thing that disappoints me about Vlad Guerrero, and that's that he's not going into the Hall of Fame as a Montreal Expo, because he was the last one. He was the last Montreal Expo who had the chance to go into the Hall of Fame wearing the Expos cap. Instead, he's going to be the first player to wear an Angels cap on his Hall of Fame plaque. And I'm only disappointed in his decision. I don't fault him for making that choice. It's a good choice. He won an MVP, and he is an Angels fan favorite. But he was the last one to be who could have gone in as an Expo, and nobody would have questioned. Now the Montreal Expo franchise has nobody left that's got the Hall of Fame written on them. So they're going to go down with having only three. And that's Gary Carter, Andre Dawson, and Tim Raines. And those aren't three bad players to have, but they could have had four, and they should have had four. But that's the decision they had that Vlad chose to make, and the Hall of Fame will probably accept that. And then finally, Trevor Hoffman. When I think of closers, Trevor Hoffman is not who I think of first. I think of Mariano Rivera first. But Trevor Hoffman is just as good as they come. Guy had over 600 saves and did make it to a World Series where he was outclassed by Mariano Rivera and the Yankees. But he was still at the top of the game and the top NL closer in an era where players were hitting home runs 500 feet or more, and he was basically baffling players with an 88-mile-an-hour fastball. You can't really do that anymore. So congratulations to the four of them, plus Alan Trammell and Jack Morris. So July 2018 is going to be quite the time in Cooperstown. That's going to do it for me here. If you missed anything, stick around because they're going to play this again. I just want to thank my man Brian Graves for making it all possible, and I'll see you all next time.
In the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.